Okay. Who here has seen the movie The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? I mean, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And not other words for that could be hero, villain, and victim. Pretty much every Western story has people that perfectly fit into those roles. In fact, pretty much every story out there has those roles in them. And the reason for that is because it makes things so simple for us. We know the hero is going to do all the good work. We don't have to think about why the villain is doing what they're doing. He's just bad. And then you have the victim. In fact, it's so ubiquitous that we often transpose these ideas onto our real life or onto stories from real life that we hear. The danger with that is that we will often miss some of the underlying story, some of the deeper stuff that is going on. One of the story we're going to be reading from John's Gospel, the people there, it's so easy to just put them into those three categories and then to just move on and not see what's going on deeper. However, I want to challenge us as we read it today to try and put away those stereotype roles and not just assume because, well, they're the bad guys, that they're of course going to do bad things. And not just bring all the baggage and assumptions we do. And hopefully that'll help us see this story from a new and different angle. So if we can bring up John chapter 8, verses 1 to 11. So I don't know how well you guys can read that, but I'll read it out loud. Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning, he was back again at the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. As he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. They put her in front of the crowd. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." Then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't you even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." So in this story, obviously the Pharisees are the bad guys. And it's very easy to just gloss over that, oh, of course they're against Jesus. But stepping back a bit, I think one of the things we initially miss is just how depraved they are, just how callous they are. The woman caught in adultery, they are actually looking to murder her. They would say they're just trying to uphold the law. But what's actually going on there is if you read the law that they're referring to, it doesn't just say the woman should be stoned. It says both people caught in adultery should be stoned. It also says they caught her in the act of adultery. And I don't know about you guys, but the facts of life that I know, it takes two to make that act happen. So if they caught her in the act, where is the guy? They are not upholding the law. They are just using her as a pawn. They're just using her as a way to get at Jesus. If you guys are curious, the trap that they're setting here is basically Jesus has two options. He can either say, stone her, but the thing is, back then, only the Romans were allowed to kill people. And so if they're the ones that reserved the right for capital punishment. So if Jesus condemned her, The Pharisees could just go to the Romans and say, hey, he killed this woman when he wasn't allowed to, and then he would be caught. Or he could say, don't stone her, and then they could say, hey, you're not upholding the law of Moses. You're a fraud. And so that's what their trap was. Now, it isn't as clear in this translation, but in the NIV, the very last phrase that Jesus says to the woman caught in adultery is, go and leave your life of sin. Or in the Orthodox Jewish Bible, it's translated to leave your practice of sin. The point I'm trying to get at here is, it wasn't a one-time thing for her. She had a habit, a lifestyle of adultery, and I'll get more into this later. But what I'm trying to point out here is, the Pharisees, I don't think they caught her and thought, oh, now we can use her as a trap. They thought out this trap for Jesus. And then they were like, okay, who can we use? And they're like, oh, we know, she's going to be doing it, so we're just going to need to keep watch. And they followed her and then brought her to Jesus. This was just how callous they were. But so then the next question is, why? I mean, if you're just going to look at them as a villain, well, of course, they're the villains. They do bad stuff. But they're actually human beings. And so what's going on for them? Well, if you look, there's a lot of examples in the Bible of how people react when they come into God's presence. When Peter first realizes that Jesus is God, what does he say? He says, get away from me. I'm a sinner. Or Isaiah, when he enters into the Holy of Holies, his first reaction is, ah, I'm a sinner. Or you have the Israelites, when God is coming, asking them to come to him on Mount Sinai, they beg and plead Moses to say, go instead of us. We don't want to come near to God. All these people felt threatened by the presence of God. In fact, all the way at the very beginning, in the Garden of Eden, after Adam and Eve disobeyed God and brought on a fallen world, what was the first thing that they did when God came to reach out for them? They covered up, they hid, and they pointed fingers. They blamed. They felt threatened. So what's going on here? If you read the very last verse of Genesis 2, just before Adam and Eve experienced the knowledge of good and evil, just before that happened, it says they were naked and they felt no shame. What happened is, after Adam and Eve disobeyed, sin and shame came in, and their behavior afterwards is classic response to shame. So before I go any further, I want to make clear what I mean with shame. I don't mean embarrassment. I don't mean the feeling you get if you pee yourself in front of the class, or you're trying to impress somebody, you open your mouth and you insert your foot so deeply that they have to rush you to the emergency. I don't mean that. I also don't mean guilt. Guilt is a reaction to an action. Guilt says, I did something wrong. Shame says, there is something wrong with me. Shame is about who I am. Shame is the belief that I am fundamentally, irredeemably, hideously flawed. That my soul is ugly. We all hear it in different ways. Some of us might hear it as, you know what? I'm never going to be good enough. Others might hear it, no one can love the real me. I'm worthless. I'm afraid that I won't measure up. It's the feeling that when the chips are down and it's time to reveal the cards, you're holding a pair of threes when you should have four aces. It's the feeling that your soul is ugly. That's what shame is. And when Adam and Eve sinned, a voice entered in that started saying things like, "Of course you're gonna fail. Who do you think you are? What do you expect? There's no way they could really love you. Do you think you're important? You don't matter one bit." A voice of condemnation came in. So that's what shame is. And here's kind of how shame works. So I've got this rock here. It's a perfectly cromulent rock. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this rock. It's a really nice rock. What I've got here is chicken manure. The act of condemnation, when someone condemns, they pour out shame on top of you. Anybody want to touch the rock now? Anybody? No? The rock is still a perfect rock. But now that it's covered in chicken manure, in shame, no one wants to do anything with it. So what do we do with it? We end up covering it up. We mask it. We hide it. Because no one wants to show their shame. No one wants to show what's going on inside of themselves. We hide it from everyone, even from ourselves. And here, can you see the chicken manure anymore? It's gone, but so's the rock. And so there's a bunch of different strategies that we use to cover up our shame. One of the strategies that we use, I call the look good strategy. And the idea behind it is, if I look good enough, if I present good enough, it doesn't matter if I'm not good enough inside. If I can get everyone to believe that I'm good enough, maybe even myself, then I'll be good. And I can look at myself in the mirror and say, yes, I'm good. And then so much energy goes into maintaining how we look, into making sure we do the right things. And that's how you get legalism. That's how you get people that are so fiercely dedicated to a cause, because they need that cause to tell them that they are good. That's how you get people who are willing to do anything, even murder, so that they can maintain their image, so that they can think of themselves as the good guys. That's how you get people like the Pharisees. And so that's why I think Jesus' statement of "let him who is without sin throw the first stone" is such a brilliant statement. He gets at the very core. In one phrase, he gets at what I've taken half a message to get at. He cuts through all their BS and gets at the core of what's really going on for you here. Now, it may just look on the surface that Jesus is reprimanding them, that Jesus is just standing up for the woman caught in adultery. But I actually see it also as an invitation to the Pharisees, an invitation to leave aside their games, to leave aside all this effort that they've done. To me, it's the same thing as what the father did for the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son. The father went out to that son who was angry and who was so caught up in always obeying the law, keep doing everything right. And he invited him in. And I see that sentence as Jesus also inviting them to leave aside their look good strategy and step in. What about the woman? What about the woman caught in adultery? Do you think she felt shame? Definitely. She was labeled by society around her. As I said earlier, it wasn't a one-time act. This was her habit. This was pretty much her identity in her society. And so what you had is there was that voice going on for her that was saying, you know what? They'll only love you if you do this. No one can love you for who you really are. And then there was also the Pharisees and all of society pouring more shame on her. And so her strategy for covering over her shame, her strategy for dealing with that is what I call the feel-good strategy. And the idea behind that one is to just throw yourself into pleasure and chase good feelings, to just relentlessly, remorselessly go after anything that makes you feel good, so that hopefully you can get enough momentum that you'll forget about your shame, that you'll be carried on a wave of ecstasy through life, so that you don't need to feel the underlying stuff. And that's why you get people who, with such addictive behaviors, who don't care about who they hurt, who leave behind a wake of brokenness behind them. People who are willing to do anything, even commit adultery, in order to feel good. And now I come to what's probably the hardest part of this message for me, because it's easy to talk about the Pharisees and their shame, and the woman caught in adultery and her shame. It's easy to just leave it out there as this general thing. But I know that I've been there myself too. I know that when I've had a fight with Anna Marie, or when I feel unproductive at work, the shame in me rises to the surface. And old voices come saying, you know what, you're not being good enough, Matt. You're not measuring up. You're not who you're supposed to be. You're not who you should be. And so then the first thing I do is I usually look for something with sugar in it. Some chocolate, or some pastry, or something like that. And then the next thing I do, I'll tell myself I'm going to do better next time. I'm going to work harder. Right, Matt? I'm going to be a better husband. I'm not going to go do those things that I shouldn't do. And then I get tempted to go on the internet and start looking at stuff that I shouldn't look at. And then that feeds my shame again, and I feel worse about myself. And the real scary thing is, and this is what Jesus did both for the woman and for the Pharisees, when he told the woman, go, leave your life of sin. And when he said to the Pharisees, you know what? When he said to the Pharisees, he who is without sin, throw the first stone. He goes and he takes off, cuts through all the stuff we use to cover our shame. And that's a hard thing. It's a scary thing. We don't want to look at our shame. I don't want to look at my stuff. I don't want to see what I think is there. I don't want to look at myself in the mirror and believe that I'm no good. I should have brought a garbage can up here. Excuse me for 2 seconds. Oh, thank you, Lindsay. And so, but the thing is, you know how I said at the beginning that shame is a belief, is a belief that we are fundamentally, hideously, irredeemably flawed. There's another belief. There's another voice. It doesn't whisper condemnation. That voice says, you are beloved. You matter to me. Look at the cross where I showed how much you matter to me. You are enough. You are more than enough because of what I've done at the cross. You are victorious because of my work. What Jesus did at the cross is he takes the stuff off. So that we are a perfectly cromulent rock again. It's a belief. One is a lie, the other is the truth. And it's our choice, when we hear those voices, which one we're going to believe. Whether we're going to listen to the one that says, you suck. Of course it was going to end like that. Or the one that says, no, don't be afraid. I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. You are my friend, my beloved. You are my son, my daughter. Thank you. So I think we're going to have the worship band come up again. And then for anybody that needs prayer or anything, I think there's people around.